It's time once again for Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Bressel, who for 5 years has shared with us her extensive research into political assassinations and abuses of power in this country. Her program relates the news of the week to emerging evidence about the conspiracy which allegedly maintains by force its control over the legislative, executive, and judicial processes in America. And now, Mae Bressel.
Good afternoon. This is Mae Bressel in Carmel, California. It's August the 7th, 1976. I have to look it up. I forget what day it is. It goes so fast. And this is Dialogue Conspiracy number 227 for those of you who keep record of them and make tapes and want copies of the shows. You can write and subscribe by the month, hopefully, or if you want individual copies. And you're very specific about what the subject matter was, or number them. It really helps to take care of that matter. Last week on KLRB, I briefly mentioned a trial that I was going to attend out of the Carmel area and asked if there were some listeners that wanted to go there with me. And I want to talk about that trial today because it was extremely interesting and it was quite an education, I might say, for the friends that did go up. It was in San Jose, and I was hesitant to mention anything about the case until I was really sure about what was going on, and after I was there, I decided that this week I should share the information with you and play around with the idea of what is happening and let you think about it, and maybe you want to go up next Thursday, August the 5th, or down if you're in Santa Cruz or wherever, and come down to the trial, and I'll give you the information on it. A man was arrested outside of Hunter Liggett. This was June the 29th, 1976. A month ago, there was an article in the Monterey Herald in our local area here and in the Salinas paper, a very small article, just about 3 inches long, and it caught my eye, and I'll read it to you. For those of you that haven't noticed it, many people did notice it and called me about it. It said, the FBI arrests a man at Hunter Liggett death. A 29-year-old San Francisco man was arrested today by the FBI agents and charged with manslaughter following the death of a still unidentified woman who fell from a speeding car at Fort Hunter Liggett early yesterday morning. FBI Special Agent in Charge Charles Bates announced the arrest this morning of Michael Vladimir, and this is the name, Apcalitz is the way the judge pronounced it in the case. It's A-A-B-C-A-L-I-X-Y-Z. It said he was from San Francisco. He worked as a laborer in the oil fields near San Ardo. Oil fields are down by San Luis Obispo. Bates said Apcalitz was arrested at the home of a relative in San Miguel by agents and a San Luis Obispo County Sheriff's deputy at 1 a.m. today. Bates said that Apcalitz was to be arraigned before the U.S. Magistrate Francis Carr on a manslaughter charge this afternoon. The arrest followed an incident near Jolin at about 1:30 a.m. yesterday. According to the affidavit accompanying the FBI complaint, a sedan identified as belonging to Apcalitz was leaving Fort Hunter Liggett, and as it neared the military police gate post, the military police on duty heard screams coming from the vehicle. And while attempting to flag the car down, they saw a woman exit from the passenger side and fall on the side of the road. The woman was flown by helicopter to the Memorial Hospital in King City, where she was pronounced dead on arrival. The FBI agent said she appeared to have died instantly. The coroner's report indicated the woman died because of a broken neck. The car continued on for a short distance. It careened off a road. It crashed into some logs. The driver was seen fleeing barefoot from the vehicle and later was arrested at the home of a relative down by the San Luis Obispo San Miguel Mission in that area. Well, why did that story interest me? First of all, whenever Charles Bates' name is in a story, I'm interested in it. Charles Bates was the FBI agent in charge of this Chicago offices. He worked there at the time of the COINTELPRO program that killed Fred Hampton and Mark Clark, and there's more coming out now. Released, this trial's going on in Chicago on the role of the FBI and the plans to kill the Black Panthers, and Mr. Bates was the agent in Chicago during this incident. He then went on to Watergate and worked for the FBI and involved investigating the Watergate at the height of the suppression of evidence when the FBI and the CIA were working to keep the truth from the American people before James McCord started spilling the beans. And then he came out and he was in charge of the Patty Hearst case, which I have alleged was fomented by the military and the CIA and the FBI. So whenever Mr. Bates gets into a case, I'm interested. Now, he was very shy to get into the Chowchilla kidnapping affair, even though kidnapping is an FBI matter, and they did pass straight state lines, and they even went across the country to Canada. And as soon as they had three suspects, three good patsies, the FBI quickly drew out of that. So I was interested in the role that Mr. Bates played, because it was a military base at Hunter Lincoln, and he was conducting, evidently, the interview. He was quoted several times. Secondly, it did involve a military base and oil fields, and I've followed some of the counterintelligence that's taken place at the oil fields since the SLA and the bombings of certain oil fields, and the money from oil for funding various congressmen, and a method of counterintelligence. The oil industry has been a front, and his man's occupation was down at the oil fields. Another thing that interests me was his name, Michael Vladimir Abkalitz, because Vladimir brought to my mind Vladimir Zatko. That's an alias for a man that was brought to this country from Europe who was put in San Quentin to kill Sirhan Sirhan. When he squealed and wrote to Judge McBride in Sacramento about the assignment that he had, he was locked up tighter, and I've had word that he is at Vacaville, and they were giving him drugs, and that he was in a very sad case. As a matter of fact, if he hears this show, he might write to me at KLRB if he can, or have some friends write, and maybe we can keep up with Mr. Vladimir Zatko. Oh, that's an alias. This man's name was Vladimir, and then the AAB, C-A-L-I-X-Y-Z, I knew immediately was a fake name. This is not the existing name of the man. And I read on KLRB at least once about a rapist, a man who committed crimes in Virginia, who, instead of being put in jail or prison in Virginia, was sent to a school for hypnosis in Orange County, California. And then he committed other crimes in California, was sent to a Tuscadero, but he was to be a guinea pig for hypnosis programs. And I knew that CALI told me that he was from out of state, and that CALI, California, was his base of operation. So AAB is the first part of his name, then CALI, and then XYZ. So, of course, I was interested in who the man was. And then the man fled the scene of the crime barefoot. His car was crashed, and he ran barefoot. And it would be hard for the officials not to find him at that time if they wanted, but very conveniently or somehow, he was at the relative's home in San Miguel. And San Miguel and San Luis Obispo and Hunter Liggett, for those of you who don't know the area, is south, quite a bit south of San Francisco for the South San Francisco FBI to be into the case is interesting. But the federal courts, I believed somewhere there may be a federal court or a court for this kind of case in the area or close to the area, and not move the case immediately to San Jose. But that's where the case was moved after the first arraignment in Salinas. The case was moved to a federal building in San Jose. The next article a few days later on this particular suspect said that his name was not Mr. AABCALIXYZ, as I knew immediately, but Mr. Abkalitz was now Robert Allen Violet. And I didn't believe that he was Mr. Violet either, but that was confirmed at the court hearing, even though they really don't have his name. And he changed to be 40 years old and not 29. And he was from South Dakota. And he had escaped from a prison in South Dakota in 1959, where he was convicted on a previous first-degree murder charge. And was sent. He was out in California working for an oil company and on the grounds at Hunter Liggett at a military base. And this time, there was no mention of the woman who was killed and no description at all. Again, it was just that there was be a court hearing July 15th. And this newspaper article that came out that followed it said that there was going to be a possible indictment. It said Mr. Violet, Robert Allen Violet, was bound over to the federal grand jury Thursday for a possible indictment. He appeared before the federal magistrate, Norden Blacker, and continued the matter to July the 15th. He had escaped from South Dakota on a murder charge 3 years ago, and he was there was no question about the fact that this girl was seen in his car screaming and thrown out and died of a broken neck. But they weren't sure that they would indict him. And the next article we heard, which was also just about 2 inches long on about the 30th page of our newspaper, that there'd be a possible indictment. The next article the following day was that Michael Vladimir Avkalitz was arraigned on a manslaughter charge in Salinas, and that he was to go before the federal criminal calendar, the magistrate in San Jose. And the name of the woman, the complaint identified the woman only as Louise Ann Nolfi, N-O-L-F-I, and that's all they said about her. Charges that Avkalitz had wrongfully caused her death by means of assault and intimidation that caused her to exit the vehicle that he was driving. So all we know about this person, she becomes a non-person, and this is one of the reasons I'm going at length on this particular case, is because Louise Ann Nolfi is not important to the case at all. And as I say, the first question was a possible indictment. Well, a fellow researcher who listens to Dialogue Conspiracy went to the first court hearing in San Jose for me 2 weeks ago because I couldn't get up there. And she took extensive notes, and she went into this federal building. The federal court in San Jose is a two-room building, three rooms really. There's a court on the right and left in a very quiet, kind of secluded area. You wouldn't know where it was, and people wouldn't know anything is going on there. And there's an office in back. And at the time, 2 weeks ago, when she went to see what was going on and to take notes on this case, the subject came up about who was this man, Mr. Avkalitz, Mr. Violet, and the public defender and the judge had a dialogue, and they came to the conclusion that he had no birth record since he was in the military service, approximately in 67. And the judge said, well, you can have a choice of two names in the case. And the public defender said, no, we'll put off till next week till we find out further who he is. And the party was standing right there. And I might say there were no handcuffs and no chains, and he had fled the scene of one murder where a woman was killed, and he had escaped from prison before and come out here, and he was not tied down like the usual kind of criminal. You wouldn't know it was a criminal case. It was handled between certain traffic violations. And so the judge said, we'll adjourn until July 29th and find out who he is. And I realized that this woman's name was not important, this Louise Ann Nolfi. Her murder wasn't important at all in this case. But the FBI was handling it for some reason, and so that's why I suggest if anyone listening wanted to attend the trial, they could. And we went up there. A few of us went up to San Jose this week. And the public defender stood before the magistrate at 9:30 in the morning and presented Mr. Avkalitz, Mr. Violet, and requested all charges be dismissed, because the federal government and the U.S. attorney had not filed charges yet on the case. And they mumbled something about, did it go before the grand jury? And then there was some mention, I couldn't even hear her. The woman's name wasn't mentioned at all. They just said, was she exhumed? And they mumbled something back. I don't know anything about the case. And the implication was that the public defender said, my client is entitled to a speedy trial. And being as he was arrested, the woman was murdered June 29th, and this was July 29th, he thought that all charges should be dropped. And the judge said, well, we'll convene until Thursday, August the 5th in the Federal Court of San Jose and consider whether charges should be dropped. Now, why am I so interested in this case? I think that maybe I've studied too much about the history of Nazi Germany and what happened when people disappeared. I've talked about Michael Bone and Carmel, who disappeared here in June, who hasn't been seen. You read your paper this morning. If you live in the Santa Cruz area, there's an ad of three beautiful people who disappeared and one whose bloody clothing was found. I've got it here. Have you seen these women? They've been missing since Friday, June 25th. And you realize that here's a woman that's been slain. There's not an article about her. There's not a description of whether she's a secretary at Hunter Liggett, of what she's doing there, whether she works in the kitchen or clings, or whether this involves drug traffic, or was she party to, say, a homosexual ring in the Army, or drug traffic in the Army, or what did she know at Hunter Liggett? That's where they do the laser beam experimentations. Did she work there as a full-time employee? Is she employed the federal government? I feel very, very strongly that it's our responsibility to ask questions and follow these things just like they happened in Germany. I have a deep religious conviction that we are our brother's keeper and that we can't afford to wipe it out. We can be interested in who's going to run for president. We can watch the Olympic Games. You can partake in any entertainment you want or any things that you're doing that are of interest to you. But there's still a certain time in the day where a person has to involve himself or get interested, because these things are happening. They're happening, these unsolved murders on the Monterey Peninsula, a new set of massacres ready for Santa Cruz, California violences that are unsolved, and selected patsies being zeroed in, like in all these other conspiracies, and we'll do some more on the Chowchilla. I feel it's very important to follow this case, and I think people listening to this show today could help me by calling Jim Eason or Bob Trevor on KGO and spreading word around, or Ray Bream in L.A. on the talk shows, and ask about Mr. Abcalitz, A-A-B-C-A-L-I-X-Y-Z, and ask more about the girl, the woman who was killed. Who was she? Where did she work? And ask Mr. Bates. Sometimes KGO will get him on the radio and interview him and ask him how he got in this case, and is this man going to get off, and why is it the judge isn't talking about murder charges, and how is it some people go to court years after a shootout, like the San Quentin Six are taken into court. They've been chained up like animals with 20 pounds of chains around their necks, the defendants, since 1971, every day of their life, and every day they're transported to the trials and chains around their ankles and chained to the chairs. And yet there hasn't been any violence or anything around them in 5 years since the shootout at San Quentin and the violence there in 1971. They haven't partaked in violence, and they're locked up and chained. And here's a man who is charged with a murder. He escaped from a state. He's charged with a murder in California. He fled from the scene. And he walks in totally free, and the judge is winking, and the public defender's looking. And the whole hearing, they didn't even bring up the name of the alias at all. The whole thing took exactly 3 minutes. I move, Your Honor, we have a dismissal. The U.S. attorney hasn't filed charges. It's unfair, you know, this lengthy trial we need. We'll consider it next week, come back next week, and they take the next traffic case, and that's all there was to it. So if any more of you are interested, you can contact me. I will be going up again August the 5th, and I think it's something we should get interested in. I mentioned last week also that I had been in touch with the Attorney General of Texas, and I had talked to him about the Howard Hughes case. And I want to give you a follow-up on that to let you know that the things I'm sharing with you are now moving into the courts. This is the way a lot of my research should have been doing for the last 10 or 12 years, but many people didn't take the advice and didn't move in the direction that I suggested and dragged their feet for whatever reason. But there is this three-part struggle going on in Texas and Los Angeles, California, Nevada over Howard Hughes' will. And there's a lot of reason to believe that his home was in Houston, Texas, because that's the last place where he had clear and sound mind of what he was doing. And, of course, I have a vested interest in wanting to pursue this because I wrote an article for Playgirl saying that Howard Hughes was buried in 1971. If any of you don't have that article, I had reprints made. It was from the December 74 Playgirl. And if you want reprints and you send me a self-addressed stamped envelope to my home or to KLRB, my number's in the phone book, I'll send you a copy of that article on the reasons I believe that Howard Hughes died in 1971. Now, there's all kinds of speculation or guesses about what happened to Howard Hughes, but I have a rule. I call it the Mae Brussel rule. It has to do with research and hard evidence. It goes like this. When hard evidence in a case is denied by the authorities, and when the responsibility for holding this information and covering it up continues, then there's more evidence or proof that a conspiracy is at large, because whenever there are open facts and no secrets, it's hard to conduct a conspiracy. And the more you hold your facts back, the greater likelihood there is a conspiracy. And I read to you several times on KLRB and at a public lecture here at my correspondence with Mr. Kelly of the FBI, who took the fingerprints off Howard Hughes, who was present, who received them in Washington, D.C., who made the comparisons, and what document did they compare them to. And he wrote me two letters and said that he wouldn't tell me. Dr. Robert Joling, the president of American Forensic Pathologist, tried to get an autopsy report of Howard Hughes for me. I asked him to do that, and of course, it is impossible to get an autopsy report from the Methodist Hospital in Houston, Texas. Well, Attorney General John Hill is trying to identify Howard Hughes now, and I did tell my problem, Mr. Kelly, and what I think he should do. He should check out the Boston Hospital and the illnesses that Mr. Hughes had there and certain documents from the Las Vegas era, and check out there's a double that worked for Mr. Howard Hughes. Check that double out and Brooks Randall and see if he's still alive. But I gave him a list of the elemental, very primary things to do first in regarding the fingerprints. And this week in the Houston Post, this is from Houston, Texas, an article by Phil Hevner, dated July 28th, the headline was, "The judge plans to review the Hughes autopsy data." It said, "District Attorney John Hill has requested a copy of the autopsy of Hughes. He expects to prove that Hughes was a legal resident of Texas. The autopsy report is vital to determine his state of mind in the months prior to his death." Now, this is what the Houston article is stating. Of course, we know that they're not going to do an autopsy, look at a brain that maybe is in formaldehyde, and be able to tell whether Howard Hughes wanted to move from NASA to Mexico. But what we could tell by an autopsy is that if there's certain markings on that body that were not the markings that Howard Hughes received in two airplane crashes, then the body wasn't Howard Hughes. And he's requested his autopsy report. The Houston Post went on to say that Mr. Hill wants to know how Mr. Loomis, that's Howard Hughes' cousin and works for Hughes Tool People, identified the body as being Howard Hughes. The autopsy report has been locked up at the Methodist Hospital since April the 6th. Written questions have been filed by the Attorney General of Texas and served to William Loomis. The probate judge, Pat Gregory, told the Attorney General, Assistant Attorney General, and the attorneys for the Hughes estate that he will read the report and get medical opinions. But the Hughes estate is holding out. They do not want the medical report, the autopsy report, turned over to the Attorney General of Texas because it would be put into the hands of people with no right to see it. That's a direct quotation. How Howard Hughes could move the courts any direction he wanted, and I'm documenting some of those right now for a very serious study on the Hughes case, is a fantastic story. But how the Hughes people still can manipulate the courts to ask the Attorney General of a state not to have an autopsy report. They must not be really sure that Howard is under the ground to uphold and fight it. Well, that wasn't all they did. The Attorney General asked for the autopsy report, but the next day there was another headline in the Houston Post, "The Hughes report is snagged." The Howard Hughes family and attorney, the people that would hold on to the estate and are fighting for the estate, filed a legal motion by the relatives to not let the autopsy report out. This is the article in the Houston Post that said, "A motion aimed to keep an autopsy report on Howard Hughes secret was filed in Houston Monday by the relatives of the late billionaire. The motion challenges the right of the Texas Attorney General John Hill to receive a copy of the report from Methodist Hospital, where it is on file. The autopsy on the billionaire who died en route from Acapulco to Houston was performed at the Methodist Hospital. Arguments on the matter will be heard Tuesday in the court of probate judge Pat Gregory. Attorney General Hill last week filed a formal request for a written deposition from the hospital president to produce that report. And in related documents Monday, the Harris County Medical Examiner, Dr. Joseph Yaminowitz, has said he was told that the Methodist Hospital would not let him see the autopsy report. You remember when the autopsy was done and this doctor, Yaminowitz, I can't pronounce his name, I call him Yaminowitz, Yakimitz, he had his picture, I believe, in Time Magazine or Newsweek, and we assumed that he did the autopsy at the Methodist Hospital there. But it turns out now that he did not do it. A doctor was brought down from Nevada to do the autopsy in the Methodist Hospital where he works. And Dr. Yaminowitz said he attended the autopsy the day after Hughes dies, but he didn't perform the autopsy. And if he attended the autopsy in April 1976, he certainly did not know what wounds were on the body to look for that took place in 1946. He had no way of knowing and isn't prepared to even discuss that. He said, as a matter of routine, he receives all autopsy reports from the hospital. They've cooperated with me, he says, for many, many years. I'm disappointed, and I told them. Methodist Hospital Vice President refused to comment on the hospital's handling of the report. Humanoid said there was no law to require the autopsy report to his office, but they've been doing it for the past 19 years. They've never held back. This is the first autopsy report that they've held back, and I'll bet you it's the first autopsy report that any attorney general in the United States has had to subpoena. I bet every autopsy report was available to an attorney general of a state on any other citizen in the United States except for Howard Hughes. Attorney General Hill said we'll be in court on Tuesday, which is tomorrow. That's August the 3rd. But it's interesting. None of this is in the papers. I take 10 papers a day, and I have good friends around the country who send me articles from their local areas. But this battle of the autopsy report is not in the San Francisco papers, the Los Angeles Post, the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Monterey Herald. I take 10 a day, the Salt Lake Tribune, the Deseret News, and this battle of the attorney general to get this report isn't in the news at all. This one article goes on that Mr. Hill, the attorney general, has been investigating the last years of the late recluse's life to determine the circumstances under which he lived and died. And if Gregory refuses to stop Hill's request, then the Loomises want the judge to privately examine the autopsy report only for the parts that have a bearing on the case. And they would select, and then they would seal it in the court file, and it would return to the hospital. So if the judge rules against the Hughes people on producing this report, then they're still going to ask him to screen it out and sanitize it so that the attorney general of Houston, of the state of Texas, can't get his hands on this report. Now, that battle that they're having confirms in my mind more and more that this was not Howard Hughes that was buried there in Houston. And there'd be no reason to fight this out, and they're fighting it out. And the point that I'm trying to help the attorney general with, in case you didn't hear it last week, was that if Howard Hughes was kidnapped and literally drugged and locked up with a babysitter since 1957 and moved from Los Angeles and then with armed guards to Boston and was taken out of the country, which I believe he was, in 66, and never was in Las Vegas, and then never was in Vancouver, or never was in Mexico, or Nicaragua, or London, or Nassau, and went to Mexico, and a man was forging his handwriting there, and his name's been forged since 1966. Who was running the empire? And then hopefully exhume that body. That's what I think should be done. I'm surprised it wasn't cremated, to tell you the truth, but hopefully it should be exhumed and find out about these scars and find out what happened to Mr. Howard Hughes. I don't think it would be difficult to find out what happened to Howard Hughes. I've studied it for a long time. But the thing is to get the law enforcement moving, and the federal government would never do this. The Treasury Department, the FBI, the Dallas police would never move in a case like this. They wouldn't touch it. It takes a private attorney of this stature who would maybe get $300 million in taxes for the state of Texas to pursue it on those grounds, because people can understand money. And if he can get money for the state, that's something that when you jingle that around, that's a common language, and that goes over big. And so that's what he's working on now, is to get the $300 million of the estate taxes. And I am hoping that the battle continues, and that he pursues it in the court, and the Hughes people hold it back, and we find how hard the line is on finding out the markings, the surgical markings, the dental markings, the head, the brain tumor markings, how long he's had the brain tumor, and so forth on this body that was buried in April 1976 in Houston, Texas, that I've maintained is not Howard Hughes. Well, the last 2 weeks I talked about the Chowchilla bus kidnapping, and I want to spend the next 15 minutes talking about it. This is 3 weeks in a row, and carry it to a certain conclusion, maybe for this week, just 15 minutes on the subject. I was simply livid this morning to read in the newspapers that the authorities want to settle the case on these three particular young men that were arrested. And I read one article, it was in the Salt Lake Tribune by Mike Dunstan, and it said that the sheriff is seeking a bus kidnap motive by using psychological profiles. And this is a quotation from Alameda County District Attorney John Meehan, said that they are still continuing the case, but Mr. Bates from Alameda said, not Bates from the FBI, the other Bates said, I want a psychological profile of the subjects. I want their habits, their genes, their education, their background, every known thing that could possibly be included in their motivation. We're seeking, maybe they're seeking publicity. Maybe they wanted to prove something to their parents. Was there a deeper psychological need? What are their political beliefs? And I was just fuming because the Washington Post carried a long article. He wasn't good at anything, suspect's former wife says. Special to the New York Times from Atlanta, from Oxford, Georgia. The former wife of Sonyelle Paget. Sonyelle is a singer at a nightclub, a waitress, and a dancer in Atlanta nightclub. She reminds me of Nancy Ling Perry, who worked at a topless club. She's a model, lingerie model in Atlanta. And this very beautiful name, this Sonyelle Paget, ex-wife, is helping fill in with a headline, a large two-double-space thing in the Washington Post. He was very tight on money. He didn't tell me what he had. He wasn't friendly. He didn't have jobs. He currently unemployed. You know, this is, you know, she was going into a psychological profile. He never knew what he wanted to be. He went to college for a while. He lost interest. He never told me of his dreams, except he liked to travel. Now, if you took this young woman's name and you put Marina Oswald there instead of Sonyelle Paget, you'd have the Lee Harvey Oswald story, what they're trying to say. Did these boys want to be famous? Did they want to prove it to their parents? They never had any money. And I was just simply livid, and I called up the law authorities, Alameda County Sheriff, Mr. Tom Hopkins today. I'll give you his number if you want to bother him a little. It's area code 415-874-5242. And I talked to one of his aides, and I said that I blew the psychological profile on the SLA story. The Los Angeles Police Department was going to do a psychological profile on why those six people wanted to die when the SWAT team came in, and I said they didn't want to die. I told the Alameda County Sheriff, I said Donald DeFries and Nancy Ling Perry and Camilla Hall were shot at close range, and the man who shot Don Fries was Don Gray, the acting director of the FBI's nephew, Pat Gray's nephew. And he ran down the alley, and it was cold-blooded murder before the SWAT team came in, and that psychological profiles are a CIA front. And I suggested that he check out this woman in Georgia who's saying he didn't have any money or jobs when the man had $86,000 in the bank. The inconsistencies of showing he had $86,000 in 80 vehicles. There was a man interviewed this week who said that he worked 9 months for the Woods Boy and was paid $250 an hour, every hour for 9 months. So the man was an employer. He had an occupation. He sold cars. He bought them and sold them. He wasn't poor. He knew darn well what he was doing. He was buying a $60,000 home in California, you know, that he was moving this English estate for his own residence. He had the bread in the bank. These stories, they pick these women that I'm very suspicious of as possible plans or possible intelligence agents who come out and give you a psychological profile that he couldn't hold a job. He had a perfectly good job, and he knew what he wanted to do, and he was doing it. I told the county sheriff up there, you don't talk anything about the rock quarry or Mr. Woods' property there. And the fact that three men were picked up at the rock quarry and only Woods' name was taken, the other two were never taken when they were digging and burying the bus. Or what happens at Martha Vineyards, that property that Mr. Woods owns, where Chappaquiddick and Edgartown meet. Edgartown is right next to Martha's Vineyard. And I talked about the safe houses in Reno, the trailer that was conveniently left, and just like James Earl Ray left the Missouri prison, and there was a trailer waiting for him, and the hotels in Vancouver he stayed with, and the person at Palo Alto he called. And I was simply furious that they were getting into the same psychological profile, because if there's any area of research in the whole assassination syndrome that I know, it is studying the adjectives of Lee Harvey Oswald that were created by Alan Dulles and the intelligence community of the CIA and put in the mouths of witnesses from the intelligence military establishment. People like a man who's chief of security of Convair, the F-111 was made, and people like George de Morenschild, talking about Lee Harvey Oswald, who worked in Guatemala all the time, at Bay of Pigs, who was at Yugoslavia for the intelligence community, did intelligence work all of his life, and a list of 20 or 30 people in the intelligence community talking about Lee Harvey Oswald. And so zeroing in on these three young men in the Santa Cruz area was made me furious. And then as I talked to the assistant, the Alameda County Sheriff this morning, and I went into the description of the chipped tooth and the older man and the hair on their face and the two tattoos, you know what he told me? The man said something which will stay in my mind a long time. And I said, what about the description of chipped tooth? And he says, well, that's just a 10-year-old child. She doesn't know what she's saying. He said one little girl thought one of the men had a peg leg like a pirate. And I said, well, what about the older person, the bus driver? And he said, this is a direct quotation. I tape recorded the conversation. Maybe if you want to hear it on KLRB, I'll bring it in someday. He said, this is the quotation. He said, oh, the bus driver, he has no concept of what was involved or of who was involved. The bus driver has no concept. And I said to him, you mean you come in as a law enforcement from Alameda that was filled with the COINTEL type operations and harassments in that area. I said, this conspiracy syndrome in California is ripe through your Alameda area. And you're telling me that a man has responsibility for taking 26 children to school every year for 10, 15 years. How long has he been at Chowchilla? I forget whether it was 15 or 19 years. It knew these children had a position of responsibility and responsibility for these children day and night to pick them up and leave them off. And that he tells you what he saw, and you tell me, not having seen them at the time that they were abducted, that this man has no concept of what was involved. And he said, that's right. And I was just furious. He said he has no concept of who was involved. And I think the children 10 or 12 or 14, and particularly the bus driver himself, has a pretty good concept of what was involved and who was involved. And the way they are pulling the psychological profile, I told him I would call as many radio stations around the country as I could if they start pulling the psychological profile, because I don't believe a thing about what they're doing to investigate the woman, the older man. He said, well, there were other suspects. And I said, well, do you print their name so we can find them? He said, no, we don't have enough to go on. I said, have you told the borders not to let them cross? They're probably out of the country. He said, that's right, they're probably away. I said, you can't say we want these people for questioning. You've done this with a lot of radicals or anti-war people or people suspected of bombing or protests. You've pulled them in, and in Washington, D.C., they arrested thousands of them and only got a conviction of 100. I said, you mean you can't put names out of who these people are that you suspect so that they can be brought in? He said, no, that's not the way it's done. If the hard evidence on them isn't there, they're not going to name who they are, and if they leave, and he acknowledged they probably were out of the country. So the way this thing is going to zero in is on these particular young men. Another thing that was interesting is that they tried to do a news blackout. It was only in one newspaper. I take 10 a day, and I listen to CBS or NBC or all these other radio programs, but only the San Jose Mercury last Saturday had an article about a letter that was sent, an anonymous letter to the San Jose Mercury. It was left off at their news rack, and it was obviously a planted letter like the diary of Lee Harvey Oswald or Arthur Bremer's diary or Sirhan Sirhan's diary. And the letter said that there were five questions in the letter, four questions and a comment. Why did the CIA, FBI, and the Dallas police literally pull the trigger on the guns that killed John and Robert Kennedy? The letter said. It implied that the kidnapping, the motive for the kidnapping, is to find out these things. It says, I'm a friend of the Schoenfelds. I'd like to fill the press and the public opinion in on why the Chowchilla kidnapping took place. The U.S. government agencies, the FBI, the CIA, were the only ones to be ransomed. The ransoming would include money and revelations concerning government affairs. We're sorry that we hurt the families that were used, these children and their loving families, in such a political escapade. Provisions were made in underground shelter for their safety and survival. Weapons had to be used in the case of an unexpectancy with law enforcement officials. We're not an offbreed of the SLA or radical terrorist groups, but we want revelations. One, why was the CIA, FBI, the Dallas police literally pull the trigger on the guns that killed John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy? Two, why don't you expose the 13 people on this planet actively responsible for control of 80% of the Earth's government? Three, expose the latter's purposes, their evil intent, and goals already initiated. Four, explain to the people of this country that by the year 1982, the world will silently be under total control by as yet unexposed forces. There are many unanswered questions, and we want to ponder them. And it suggests that they were going to take the ransom money or force the CIA to tell why they did the assassinations. But it's an interesting concept, even though I don't take the letter too seriously, because then you assume that the CIA also would be part of the Chowchilla bus kidnapping. The way the letter is written, it seems to me that the CIA in turn would know something and that they were being blackmailed. It's an interesting long letter, and it made the front page of the San Jose Mercury by a staff writer, Frank Sweeney, a staff writer for the San Jose Mercury, carried to another page. But the Associated Press, United Press, and the news media didn't pick up any connections or any suggestion of the Chowchilla or possible links to information on who killed John Kennedy or Robert Kennedy. This was kept off the news media and all other sources except the paper to which it was directed. They thought it was important enough to print a large article and a reproduction of the message, but nobody else picked it up. The Rand Corporation did a study in 1973, and Brian Jenkins wrote this study for them on terrorism. He said, in quotes, "Terrorism is aimed at the people watching, not the actual victims. Terrorism is theater. The audience is worldwide. The psychological adaptation to terrorism has only begun." That's the Rand Corporation in 1973. They were commissioned to study a series of reports on terrorism. In 1974, the Patty Hearst kidnapping began the era of terrorism in America, which I call the military terrorism of the right, which Fletcher Prouty has intimated and said was part of a military operation that the Pentagon knew where Patty was the entire summer when she was in Pennsylvania. Now, the emergence of the SWAT team, incidentally, the SWAT team that became part of the American scenery when the 6th SLA was killed, that was founded by a Los Angeles policeman named Jim Doherty, who happened to be the first husband of Marilyn Monroe. And Jim Doherty left the Los Angeles Police Department when Marilyn Monroe was riveting at Lockheed Aircraft, which is a very interesting story. She was discovered by a man named Howard Hughes, who set up the nude photographs of Marilyn Monroe. And then her husband went to Arizona, where he was later called by the LAPD to have rifle range and practice and set up the first SWAT teams in America. And then Marilyn Monroe later was put strategically introduced into the company of Attorney General Robert Kennedy and President John Kennedy and placed in the beds of these two men and slain in the fall of 63. And John Kennedy was killed in November 63. And the mystery and the mystique of placing this woman from Lockheed to Hughes to the bed of the Kennedys when he won the election in 1960 is an interesting phenomena. And her first husband was the founder of the SWAT team. And a lot of things that we take as the glamour and the glitter of Hollywood, as you study more and more, is a very Machiavellian manipulation of people and minds. And behind some of the very good movies are some other stories that are equally important in a political spectrum. Now, the Rand study said that many former hostages complained that they were treated like social pariahs, as if they were lepers. Those were their words. And I think of Patty Hearst. This week, her mother came out, Catherine Hearst, and said, everybody's making a fuss about the Chowchilla children who were abducted for something like 30 hours. And Patty was kept in a closet for an entire month. And she was kept with some people who already claimed that they'd killed Dr. Marcus Foster and they would kill her. And she was locked in a closet for a month. And as Rand said, many former hostages complain to be like social pariahs and lepers. And this is exactly what happened to Patty Hearst. When she was kidnapped and kept hostage in a closet, and these people had weapons and foul talk and language around her that she wasn't accustomed to and threatening her, and she was kept secluded. Later, she was chained. The chain, she was flown, wakened in jail early in the morning and flown after chest surgery, a collapsed lung. She was taken in an automobile ride 400 miles to the San Diego jail. But the Woods boy, when he's flown from Canada, goes on a commercial airline like a civilized passenger. He has buried children who could have been asphyxiated within 6 or 8 hours under the ground, 27 people. And Mr. Woods is flown like a gentleman and gets the red carpet treatment home from Canada. But Patty Hearst is still treated like the leper and the social pariah and chained. even though she had no experience with weapons until these people abducted her and taught her. Incidentally, today, just yesterday, the Atherton police chief all of a sudden resigned under a cloud of suspicion. This is from the San Francisco Chronicle, and it's interesting because the Schoenfeld family, the Woods boys, came from Atherton. And it says, the Atherton police chief, Sheridan Flanders, 49, abruptly resigned under a cloud of suspicion linked to the activities in his office. A 28-year veteran of the town police, who was named the chief of police in 1972, gave no reason in his one-sentence letter. He skipped Atherton, he skipped town, and he's fled there. And I think that there will be a lot in Atherton to investigate. Well, our time is up. We may do more on Chowchilla next week, and I may get on to the book, A Betrayal. I want to talk about Robert Murrow and some more on the John Kennedy assassination. I'll see you next week on Dialogue Conspiracy. Until then, take care.